words don't belong together. Worship. This is what our Creator and Redeemer deserves and desires from us. And it's what those who truly know Him delight from their heart of hearts in giving to Him. Wars? That's what enemies do. Fight and kill each other. Worship wars. How can people who delight to worship their God go to war with each other? The sad reality is that it's happening in church after church. Last week I mentioned a book that I've just finished by Gordon MacDonald entitled Who Stole My Church? It's a fictional account of a New England church that's working through the challenges of entering the 21st century. This particular account has a 70-year-old pastor whom Gordon MacDonald writes himself in as the pastor of this fictional church. And he begins to meet weekly with a group of about 15 of the old-timers to hear their concerns, as well as meeting with some of the young people. And eventually in the book he brings them together. And there's a fascinating discussion in chapter 9 about the subject of church music, in which the pastor has this to say in one of the meetings with these church veterans. And I quote now from chapter 9. "Let me tell you some of the things I hear from you when the subject of music comes up. And I read from a list I'd written out that afternoon. One, there's no choir, and you're missing that, and some of you miss singing in it. Two, we sing too few familiar hymns, at least what are considered to be hymns. No one sings in harmony anymore. Three, when we sing, it's too loud. When the volume is turned up, our ears hurt, especially those with hearing aids. Four, we repeat too many last lines over and over again. Five, some think that few of the new songs contain any doctrine or truth. Six, some of us literally feel physical pain from standing too long. Seven, many folks are just not into clapping." Later in the story, the pastor invites some of the younger praise band leaders to come and meet with the older folks and to talk together about their feelings regarding these issues, as well as a lot of other stuff. You have to read the book to see what happens, but I want to repeat a statement that I made last week, and it's just simply this. It's amazing what happens when the older and younger generations in a church actually get together, speak the truth in love, work hard at listening to each other, and then, laying aside personal preferences, seek to do what will most exalt Christ together. And I'm so thankful that that describes what's happening in our church. Do we have differences in terms of our perspectives? Sure we do. But it thrills me to see the older and younger believers talking, seeking to understand and prefer one another so that together, not fragmented, but together, we may exalt Christ in this community. Now, having said that, it's not a new problem. You may have noticed that I entitled the message, Worship, It's Not What It Used to Be. And I don't have in mind what's happening in the 21st century in America. I have what was going on in the first century when we come to the book of Hebrews, chapter 9. Did you realize that worship in Israel had not changed at all for centuries? I mean that literally. If starting with Moses, if you were a good Jewish family, you went to the tabernacle on a regular basis, year after year, just like your parents had done, and their parents had done before them, the furniture in the tabernacle never changed. The activities in the tabernacle never changed. It was always the same. Granted, after 500 years of doing that, worshiping in the tabernacle, there was a change, and I don't know how he ever pulled it off. Solomon decided to build a building called a temple, and they got rid of the tabernacle. I'm not sure how that ever took place, but there was a change, and then that temple was there, and they used that. But basically, Solomon just patterned everything after the way it was in the tabernacle. Furniture's the same, everything's patterned the same in the temple. And that went on for centuries, and then Jesus came to earth, announcing in Matthew 5:17, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And all of a sudden, 1,400 years of tradition changed. The book of Hebrews was written to address for a Jewish audience why those changes had come. The writer shows that Christ is superior to all that had come before him. Superior to Moses, superior to Aaron and the priests, superior to the Levitical system, superior indeed to the whole Old Covenant. In fact, it all pointed to him and was fulfilled by him. Now, I need to tell you right up front that the purpose for this instruction in Hebrews was not academic. If Christ is superior, and he is, then he should be superior in your life, no matter what the cost. This is not just, the writer has a very life-changing perspective in mind for going into all of these details about what Christ has changed and why he changed it. You and I ought to value, if he's really superior, we ought to value him above all else and be willing to pay whatever price is necessary to show our allegiance to him, including facing ridicule, even persecution for refusing to follow the party line of the world around us. We'll come back to that when we come to the end of our study. The fact is, Jesus Christ changed the way people worship. How so? Well, we come to Hebrews chapter 9 in our ongoing journey through this amazing epistle, and in the first 10 verses, we discover three insights into Old Covenant worship. And as we look at these, it'll certainly stand out how we don't worship the way they used to. First of all, worship involved, under the Old Covenant, a specific place. Verse 1 states, "Now the first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary." The writer mentions the first covenant, and that's referring to the covenant that God had established with Israel there on Mount Sinai around 1440 BC. Under the first covenant, worship involved a specific place. Where did it take place? In the Old Covenant, there was an earthly sanctuary. The term sanctuary comes from the Greek term hagion, which just simply means holy place or set apart place. And here we're told by the writer that this was an earthly holy place. That's interesting. The only other time that word earthly appears in the Bible, it's in a negative context. Titus 2:12 talks about worldly, uses the adverb worldly. But here, this isn't saying that the tabernacle was worldly in a bad sense, because remember, it came from God. The point is that in contrast to the heavenly tabernacle, mentioned back in chapter 8, verse 2, and will be mentioned in chapter 9, verse 11, the first tabernacle was earthly because it belonged to this world. The tabernacle was 45 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high. I don't know exactly what that would look, but we're talking about a tent that would fit inside this room easily. It was comprised of two rooms. The first room was called the Holy Place, which took up two-thirds of the overall space, and the second room, the Most Holy Place, also known as the Holy of Holies, which took up one-third of the space, and it was actually a 15-foot cube. In verses 2 through 5, the writer gives us this detailed description of the contents of those two rooms. Listen, beginning in verse 2. "A tabernacle was set up in its first room where the lampstand, the table, and the consecrated bread," this was called the holy place. "Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered ark of the covenant. And then inside this ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above this ark were the cherubim of the glory overshadowing the atonement cover. But we cannot speak of these things in detail now." Commentator Raymond Brown makes the observation. The writer seems to linger over the sacred treasures of the past. There was, he says, something majestic and attractive in the Mosaic ordinances of worship. Christians do not doubt that. Rather, they acknowledge that the beauty and meaning of the law, through that, the beauty and meaning of the law, they understand the gospel better. That's the statement I want to pull out. by looking at this tabernacle, we can understand the gospel of our Savior better. So with that aim in mind, let's ponder the specifics. There were two rooms in the tabernacle. The first room was called the Holy Place. In it was the lampstand. If you have a King James Bible, it's called the candlestick, but there were no candles in it. They didn't use wax. These were actually, this was a lampstand that was made of pure gold and had seven branches with bowls shaped like almonds on each tip that held oil for burning. There were no windows inside the tabernacle, so this provided the necessary light for the priests to function. On the other side of the room, called the Holy Place, was a table that was overlaid with gold on which loaves of bread were arranged in two rows of six loaves of bread, and you can read about that in Exodus 25 and Leviticus 24. On this table, there were these 12 loaves, and apparently these represented the 12 tribes of Israel. The priest would replace that bread every Sabbath on this table of showbread, as the King James translation calls it. At the back of the holy place was a veil or a curtain, and on the other side of that was the room that was indeed the most sacred room and space in all of Israel, called the Most Holy Place. Inside this room, known as the Holy of Holies, the writer reminds us, was the golden altar of incense. You can read about that in Exodus 30, verses 1 to 6, if you're interested. This golden altar was actually a cubit long, 18 inches, foot and a half, cubit long, cubit wide, and 2 cubits high. It was covered with gold and had 2 rings on it for transportation purposes. The priest didn't pick this stuff up and carry it. They had to use poles. You remember the other account where someone touched one of the sacred pieces of furniture and died on the spot for it. On this altar, the sons of Aaron burned incense every morning, according to Exodus 30, verse 7. Do you remember the story of John the Baptist, particularly his father Zechariah? Zechariah was a priest chosen by lot, according to Luke 1:9, to, quote, go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. Since he wasn't a high priest, he burned the incense where the ordinary priests went each day. That was in the outer sanctuary, the holy place, and Luke's account indicates that in the first century, the temple, the altar of incense was located in the outer place, that holy place. In fact, Exodus 30, verse 6 says that's where it was in the tabernacle too. That this thing, this box called the golden altar of incense was in the holy place, the first room. But the writer of Hebrews says it was in the Holy of Holies. Did you catch that? Not in the outside room, but in the very Holy of Holies, the most holy place. And that's raised all kinds of questions for commentators. He says it's inside the... Well, they've known for centuries it was in the other room. Why does he say it's in the inside room? Leon Morris gives this helpful thought. The writer does not say his altar was in the most holy place, but only that place had it. If we were to lay out the room, he'd come into the outer room, the holy place, you would actually find this altar towards the curtain that separated the two rooms. The dividing barrier into the Holy of Holies was this curtain, and this altar of incense was right up near that curtain. So that, placed there purposefully, the incense that would be burnt on that altar would produce smoke that would carry from the holy place into the most holy place. Wiersbe points out, the golden altar did not stand in the Holy of Holies, but its ministry pertained to the Holy of Holies. That's the best I can do to figure out why the description is that it's in the most holy place. You can do some study on your own and see if you can come up with a better explanation. There is no question, however, about the fact that the primary piece of furniture in the most holy place, indeed in the entire tabernacle, was the Ark of the Covenant. This ark was nearly 4 feet long and a little over 2 feet wide and 2 feet high. Think of a gold-covered chest. Inside the ark were three things. The writer says there was a golden jar of manna to remind the people of how God had provided for them in the wilderness. There was Aaron's staff, which was the one that budded after Korah's rebellion. The budding was an indication that God had chosen Aaron's line to be the priest in Israel. And then there were these two stone tablets that recorded the Ten Commandments. Moses had actually smashed the first set of tablets, you'll recall, when he came down from the mountain only to find the Israelites dancing around this golden calf. And God mercifully gave Moses two more tablets, and those ended up inside the Ark of the Covenant. It's worth noting that 1 Kings 8:9 says that in Solomon's temple there was nothing inside the Ark of the Covenant except for those two stone tablets. The man was gone, and so was the bud, the budded rod, the staff. 400 years later, after Jerusalem was destroyed in 586, the ark disappeared, and we don't know where it is to this day. Still later, in Herod's temple, the one that Jesus would have visited and which the Romans destroyed in AD 70, the Holy of Holies was ark-less. In fact, the Holy of Holies was basically empty at that time. Hebrews 8:5 says that above the ark were the cherubim of the glory. Exodus 25, verses 18 to 21 explains that these were gold-covered sculptures of two angelic beings, one on one side of the ark and the other on the other, a stunning reminder of the presence of the glory of God. The lid that covered this box called the ark was referred variously as the mercy seat, or the NIV calls it the atonement cover. The Lord told Moses in Exodus 25, 22, and I'm quoting, "There, above the cover between the two cherubim that are over the Ark of the Testimony, I will meet with you and give you all my commandments for the Israelites." And then after all of this intriguing description of the furniture in both the holy place and the most holy place, the writer makes a curious disclaimer of sorts in verse 5, stating, "But we cannot discuss these things in detail now." Which, I don't know about for you, but for me it raises the question, why not? Why can't you discuss these things in detail now? Is this just the typical thing that a preacher or teacher says when he's exhausted everything that he can say about a subject? There's more I could say, but we will not say more now. I don't think so. This fella knew his Jewish history. I'm sure there's a lot more he could have said. In fact, in a few moments, I'll give you some of the speculation of what other rabbis said. They did a lot of talking about those pieces of furniture and what they represented. He says, we can't talk about this more now. Why does he say that? My opinion, and it's only my opinion, but I think it bears up as you think about it with me, is that he couldn't talk about more concerning those elements now because there was something else that was more critical for him to talk about. Let me remind you of something that we mentioned a while back in this series. The book of Hebrews, we call it a book, but it was probably originally a sermon. Chapter 13, verse 22, he ends this book by saying, "I've given you a brief word of exhortation." And we read that and think, brief? Compared to Philippians, 4 chapters, Colossians, 4 chapters, Hebrews is 13 chapters. That's not brief. He didn't say it was a brief book. He said it was a brief word of exhortation. This was probably originally a sermon that was preached to a predominantly Jewish assembly of believers. It was a sermon. It was a brief word of exhortation. It was a typical, meaty sermon, 50 minutes. I don't know if you time me, but that's about a 45 sometimes 50-minute sermon. That's a meaty sermon. And he comes to the end and he says, "I've given you a brief word of exhortation." Now, plug that thought into what he's saying here when he says, we can't discuss these things in detail now. It makes sense to me, at least, as a preacher. When a preacher says we can't discuss these things in detail now, it usually means I'd like to say more, but I won't because there's something more pressing that deserves our attention, and so we must press on. Now stop and think about that for a moment. In worship, it is so easy to get distracted. It's easy to become preoccupied with things that are supposed to be a means to an end. In the tabernacle, these pieces of furniture were a means, not the end. They were supposed to be a means, and they were a God-given means, remember, to the end of worshiping Him acceptably. Sadly, for many, they became a substitute for that end, which is why you recall the story in John chapter 11, where after Lazarus was raised from the dead, the Jewish religious leaders, the priests, put out a contract on Lazarus' head and Jesus and said this: if we let him, Jesus, go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. John 11:48. They were worried about losing their sacred place, the temple. It was supposed to be a means to worshiping the living God, but they worshiped the place. They worshiped the means. Beloved, we are in trouble when we begin to worship the form rather than the person to whom the form is pointing. For some, it's a hymn book and an organ. For others, it's a video projection screen and a bass guitar. Beloved, both are just forms. They're a means. They're supposed to point us to someone. And when that's succeeding, we don't even think about the means. And quite frankly, the means change. That's why we don't go to the tabernacle anymore. It was a means to something else. And by God's design, the form has changed. But we cannot discuss these things in detail now. And so the writer intentionally refuses to keep talking about the forms of Old Covenant worship for the simple reason there's something more important to talk about. Namely, as he will show us next time, Christ and the blood of Christ at the end of chapter 9. Think about it this way. In the Old Covenant, the focus was on what you can see. Worship was tied to a place. If you wanted to approach God, you had to go somewhere. You had to go to a sanctuary and approach God through a human priest. You had to bring an animal sacrifice to that priest in that place called the sanctuary. But under the new covenant, things have changed drastically. Because today we have an unseen priest, and he's serving in an unseen sanctuary. So worship under the old covenant involved a specific place. Secondly, worship involved specific practices. Verses 6 and 7. When everything had been arranged like this, the priests entered regularly into the outer room to carry on their ministry. But only the high priest.